Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to spend the first portion of our program today talking with you about bioenergy and climate change. Certainly that was on President Obama's mind last night as he talked about the state of our economy and the state of the country. And at the University of Wisconsin, we're doing quite a bit of work in the bioenergy area, and we're also doing a lot of work. I'm not doing any of it, but I'm talking about it. But there are some researchers that are doing some great work in both areas, and we're going to be talking with Chris Kucharik, for one, who's a professor in the Department of Agronomy in the College of Ag and Life Sciences at UW-Madison. He's with the Center for Sustainability and the Global Environment, and also the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. Chris, great to have you with us today. Thanks so much for coming by.
Well, thanks, Larry. I appreciate the invite.
And John Greenler has been with us a number of times. John is Education and Outreach Program Director for the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, which we often call GLBRC. And John, great to have you back as well.
Thanks very much, Larry.
Well, let's talk about bioenergy and climate change. Want to do that?
Well, yeah.
Is there a general connection between the two?
Yeah, I think we something to keep in mind, you know, why we're looking at bioenergy as a potential sort of solution, sort of a piece of the puzzle to help offset greenhouse gas emissions, which are connected to global warming and climate change. And the thing we have to remember is that, you know, our current energy sources, fossil fuels, a long time ago, these sources built up below ground, and we're talking long, long, long time periods. Mm-hmm. And as time has gone on, we've unfortunately thrown the balance of carbon dioxide and its exchange between the land surface and the atmosphere out of whack. Before the Industrial Revolution, you know, around 1850, basically the CO2 that was exchanged between the land surface, the oceans, and the atmosphere was in balance. We were sitting at about 280 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. As we've gone on, you know, over the last 150 years, and we've been taking more and more of that fossilized form of carbon below ground and rapidly putting it back into the atmosphere, we've completely disrupted the Earth's carbon cycle, mm-hmm. basically. The connection to bioenergy really is to say that we're looking at sources of energy through plants, materials that basically have a net CO2 of zero. If we're going to combust those plant materials, what happens is the CO2 that's been taken up through photosynthesis is, you know, re-released back to the atmosphere, and it's a closed cycle. Mm-hmm. So if we can begin to make that more of a prominent piece of our energy solution and decarbonize our energy way, you know, means of life, hopefully we can begin to start to mitigate CO2 buildup in the atmosphere and global warming and the greenhouse effect.
Well, it won't necessarily drop, but it won't make it worse.
That's right.
The way to put it.
Yeah, there's we're kind of on an unprecedented, you know, change in terms of CO2 increases right now, and making these changes are not going to all of a sudden start to decrease amounts of CO2 in the atmosphere. Our hope is that they can help stabilize or reduce the increase through time. We're approaching, you know, a level of CO2 in the atmosphere that a lot of climate scientists are saying are undoubtedly going to lead to unforeseeable catastrophic, you know, events and weather, and you know, we can't really turn around once we get past that point. So,
So there we are. And as we visit here, I didn't give the phone number earlier, so let me do that right now. You may want to join in with your own questions or your own comments, and if you do, I hope you will. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And you can also email us, the email address, talk@wpr.org. It's talk@wpr.org. And Chris, just in relation, before we go to the phones here, and what's the nature of the research that you're doing? And then maybe John can talk about it a little overall. But
Sure, yeah. I'm actually also affiliated with the GLBRC, the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, and actually my faculty line is part of the Wisconsin Bioenergy Initiative. So the work that I'm a part of a sustainability research team through GLBRC. And we're charged with trying to better understand how, if we move forward and start growing different types of crops or new energy crops across the landscape, which I can touch upon in a minute, what we're trying to look at, what sort of repercussions might that have on what we've referred to as ecosystem goods and services that we depend on and derive from our landscapes for life and basically our own existence here on the planet. And those categories fall into, you know, we want to know how much biomass we can actually produce from each of those cropping systems. That's the feedstock that would be used to convert into some bioenergy source, whether it's ethanol or some third generation of biofuels that we're still researching. We want to make sure that those crops are greenhouse gas neutral, meaning, you know, the whole process of making that bioenergy from cradle to grave, so to speak, doesn't actually result in a net increase in greenhouse gas emissions to the atmosphere. And we're not talking just about carbon dioxide. We're also talking about nitrous oxide and methane, which are the other two prominent greenhouse gases. How much water does each of these systems happen to use? We, you know, water is a very valuable resource, obviously, and we want to make sure that we conserve that resource and we don't choose something that needs a lot of irrigation. And a lot of places like here at home in Wisconsin are not equipped really to handle, you know, irrigation. What might it do to water quality? Obviously, we've seen issues in our area lakes here in the Madison area. Due to farming practices, phosphorus, nitrate runoff and leaching into our groundwater sources. There's a high percentage of private wells that are above the EPA limit for safe levels of nitrates. So water quality is another issue.
So lots of issues then that you're
exactly
taking into account.
Right.
And John, this is, of course, one part. There are many parts to the process.
Right, yeah. In GLBRC, we actually have four research areas that are looking at different aspects of trying to develop sustainable biofuels to address, you know, our energy needs and also look, you know, at these environmental concerns. And so in these areas, we have a really wide array of different types of research. We have a lot of different disciplines that are involved. And a really key underpinning is the sustainability research. As we think about, you know, how can microbes, for example, convert these materials into different types of fuels, for example, we really try to be broadly cognizant, you know, not only of that particular technology, which might look good in one particular step of this process of going from essentially plow to pump, you know, cradle to grave, but we really try and, you know, through this sustainability research, put it into a broader context so we can really make sure that all of the research that we're doing is headed in a direction where we will be, you know, moving towards more sustainable energy and fuel systems. So this research is really mission critical for us in terms of informing the, you know, the full diversity of research that goes on at GLBRC.
Well, lots of people to want to visit with you or have questions or comments, so let's take some calls. And first, let's go to Walt in Fort Atkinson. Walt, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks for taking my call this morning. This is a great topic, and all I wanted to do is put a plug in for my pellet stove that I have heating my house here. And I really love the thing. I just got it this year. I got advice from friends who've had them. And I decided to give it a shot because my LP furnace was way too expensive. And I really like my pellet stove. And I've also decided and signed on to buy my electricity through the We Energies renewable energy program. So I've basically become carbon neutral in my house with all my electricity from renewable resources and my pellet stove heating the house with pellets. And the cost is pretty reasonable. I'm figuring to spend in this old farmhouse about between $600 and $700 this year to heat it, and then an additional about $7 or $8 a month on my electricity bill for the renewable energy, and it gives me some bragging rights.
Well, we do the same thing in our household with the green energy. We've signed up for that as well, and so I'm kind of with you on that. I don't have a pellet stove, though. I don't know, Chris. What do you think? Comment?
I think that's it's great to see local people, you know, getting into these types of you know, renewable energy sources. The only thing I might add is that if you think about if everyone shifted and started buying pellet stoves, and all of a sudden we needed to support that feedstock, would that mean we'd have to drastically change how we were managing our agricultural lands across our state? So probably some people can make these changes, but it's not like going to be the solution for everyone. And I doubt that everyone would go down that route. But there are sort of life cycle analyses that we need to look at to see is this a real sustainable practice. Mm-hmm. But I definitely applaud the what this gentleman is doing.
I don't know. Is Walt still on the line? I just have a question.
I'm still here.
So do you know what type of material the pellets are made out of that you're using in your stove?
I've got two types. One is hardwoods from Indiana, and one is softwoods that were from trees that were infested and damaged, and they're from Colorado. I do have a friend, a fellow that is an acquaintance, who is producing his own pellets from a variety of biomass sources, including grass and so on. That's still kind of experimental. I haven't gotten a chance to use them. Also, a lot of people in this stove that I have can use corn, and I haven't used corn, but corn has more heat potential and is cheaper than pellets, but it leaves clinkers, and I just haven't gotten around to using that for that purpose.
All right.
That's great. And I think, you know, just briefly, clearly you've done a lot of your own research, essentially, to think about, you know, what are the diversity of types of materials that you can put into that stove? And it's interesting to think about, you know, what are the implications, you know, environmentally of those different types of materials? Where are they coming from? You know, what might the inputs be to have made those pellets? And clearly, you know, I think the type of considerations that you're putting in there, I think, are really important for us to be able to be broadly cognizant of, you know, the implications of moving into biofuel, bioenergy type systems. So that's great.
Thank you very much for calling, Walt. I want to give Sally and Madison a chance to join in. Sally, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I drove across the country with my husband last fall, and through Kansas and into Colorado. So much of the land that I expected to be wheat production was now corn. And especially driving back in the fall, they had cut down the corn, and there were these vast clouds of dust, which, of course, were not a happy sight. And I was just wondering about the longer-term implications of that. And one other question. At the beginning of the show, there was something about the carbon level being 280, but I didn't understand if that was in 1860 or now, and how it was measured and what it meant. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for calling, and we'll turn back to Chris.
Right. Well, let's start with the easy question on the parts per million of CO2. So, yeah, that was a pre-industrial level of CO2 in the atmosphere, and those levels are generally have been measured and estimated with ice cores and isotopic analyses of oxygen and ice from Antarctica and other places. Right now, we're sitting at about 390 parts per million. So we've increased, you know, about 110 parts per million in about 150 or 160 years, just to get the numbers straight there. Regarding the sort of visual shift, it seems, in what's been grown in states like Kansas, eastern Colorado, a shift from wheat to corn, I would say probably undoubtedly has something to do with the price of corn, bushels of corn going up considerably since about 2007. We actually use now about one out of every 5 rows of corn grown in the U.S. goes to supporting ethanol production. So that's 20%, a very significant contribution. And Undoubtedly, when we think about farming, farmers want to be profitable. They have economic considerations they're taking into account. And so we saw, I think it was the statistics were about a 15 to 20% increase in corn acreage just in that from the previous recent history to just the last few years. That's changed back a little bit now when the prices of corn have gone down from, I think it was up to $8 per bushel to about $4 per bushel. The clouds of dust undoubtedly will change from year to year depending on what the soil moisture conditions are like during the harvest. And they may have just had a very warm and dry season like we did here actually in fall when the corn harvest actually went quite well and quite fast. So, but those can have interesting repercussions on local climate, but in the very, very short term, wouldn't have really any long-term implications.
Talking about bioenergy and climate change with our two guests today, John Greenler, Education and Outreach Program Director for the GLBRC, Chris Kucharik, who is a professor at the UW-Madison, also associated with the GLBRC. Our guests here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about bioenergy and climate change with our guests today, John Greenler and Chris Kucharik. And taking an email question next, I think, guys. Dave in Livingston wonders, why aren't anaerobic digesters used to convert sewage? It's a source that we never run out of.
That's a very, very good question. I would probably say, and I'm not an expert on this, and maybe John can give his own feedback after I put my foot in my mouth about this, but I think the ease of actually taking that material and moving it to a digester is probably one consideration. Maybe another fact is a lot of, you know, rural populations who have septic, I don't really see how easy that would be to be pumping that out and trucking it and moving it around. And maybe the actual benefit on the climate system would outweigh the good things with all the movement of that material. So I think of farming and getting people sort of into the idea of taking a manure and getting farmers to buy into the idea, and that's probably a little bit easier thing to do right now in terms of infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Crave brothers, located near Watertown, have quite a digester system for their farm operation, and they have the electricity to run their own farm, plus I think another 150 homes or something like that. It's in that ballpark. So it can be done on a farm level if you've got enough, a big enough operation, let's put that.
Big enough operation, enough capital. These methane digester systems are very expensive right now. They're very much a mainstream over in Europe, in Germany and other places. And for folks that aren't listening who are in the Madison area here, we actually now have in the works our own methane digester on the north side of Lake Mendota, which I forget what the cost was, but it was in the millions of dollars to get that going.
Yeah. Yeah. Ron in Blooming Grove, we turn to you next. Hi, Ron.
Some updated information. Back in 75, I studied sewage disposal as part of an agriculture course. And in Missouri, they were already using anaerobic digesters to digest hog manure. The Nine Springs treatment plant here on the south side of Madison and Monona has been using anaerobic digesters to digest the human sewage sludge for many years. I don't know when they started. I've only been here about 20 years, so I don't know when they started that. But it's been done for decades and decades. The methane coming off of those digesters is used on site to heat the plant. It's used there locally. The big question I want to talk about is non-edible bioenergy. Since 1976, I've been an advocate for renewable energy and initially virtually all renewable forms. But about 12 or 15 years ago, I saw one of those wood stoves that was burning kernel corn, dry field corn, and that turned me off. You said 20% of the corn in the U.S. is used for ethanol, which goes into cars and trucks and pickups and whatever. That is direct competition between hungry humans and hungry automobiles. And in my book, it is a mortal sin and a crime against humanity to take food out of the mouths of starving children and to put it into the fuel tank. And it doesn't matter if it's soybean oil or ethanol or the kernels of corn going into a wood stove to heat my personal house. It's still a crime against humanity.
All right. Well, let's get a comment here from, let's go to John Greenler.
Well, I think, you know, in the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, I think we couldn't agree with you more. I think this is a very important issue. And a lot of the fundamental research that we're involved in is trying to develop the breakthrough technologies which will allow us to efficiently be able to convert kind of non-edible food, non-edible biomass, plant material into liquid transportation fuels, for example. And so the systems that we're looking at, you know, into the future would be things like corn stove or the rest of the plant after you've harvested the grain, or switchgrass, which we can grow on marginal lands where we wouldn't be growing these types of grain crops. Very fibrous material, very different than the starch from corn or sugar from sugarcane, for example, and be able to convert that into ethanol or any of a number of a host of other different types of biofuels. So that will really allow us to move forward and not be in this food versus fuel, type of situation.
I think corn is really not considered an end. It's sort of, am I right on that, Chris?
Yeah. That was really the low-hanging fruit, you know, that sort of got us started. I think, obviously, people know we had a long history of taking sugars from grain of crops and turning it into alcohol. Been a process that's been going on for a long period of time. So we have that system as part of one of the ones we study, but it really is the control case. I don't want to say it's the worst-case scenario, but we need something to compare all the rest of the systems to that. So as John mentioned, you know, whether it's something like switchgrass or the actual stover from fields of crops, unfortunately that presents another trade-off. We've been promoting for years to try to get farmers to keep a lot of that residue on the soil surface at the end of the season to help prevent soil erosion. And I worry a little bit if we start moving forward and telling them, no, let's remove that because we want to actually turn it into liquid bioenergy, that might lead to a whole host of other problems, unfortunately. But I think just to iterate what John said, you know, we're really trying to look at things that do not compete with the food supply. And the person on the phone definitely makes a strong case, you know, the reasons for that.
Let's turn to James in Newton, Illinois next. Hi, James.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call there.
Sure.
I just had a couple of questions. The fuel energies that they're working on, are they looking towards something that's going to be ready, available to the general public, less expensive than crude, making diesel fuel? I'm an over-the-road truck driver. Are they also looking at something that will burn into an internal combustion motor? And then on the other hand, I see a real problem with climate change as far as, and I'm not saying there's not climate change. What I'm saying is, think of climate change, I think of Al Gore. Now, I don't mean to throw names out there, but that's the one that comes to mind. And I look at what the EPA and Al Gore has done to the United States. They have made it so hard for anybody to compete in the United States. We have pushed it over to China and Mexico, which does things a lot dirtier. Now, aren't we talking about global warming?
Mm-hmm.
And I'll take my comments off the air. I do appreciate it.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, maybe both of our guests can chime in at one point or another here. Chris, we start with you. Chris Kucharik?
So to answer the first part of the question, trying to look at sources of fuel that are economically, you know, viable for the rest of the population, well, undoubtedly, we definitely don't want to waste taxpayer money. I mean, this is funded by the Department of Energy. Obviously, everyone listening out there in some way or another is supporting this research through federal grants that the university gets. We don't want to come up with things that are not going to be able to be easily purchased or too expensive. That really is the ultimate goal. And we do have a whole team of people at GLBRC that maybe John can highlight a little bit that are sort of an economic team that want to look at these economic trade-offs.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
Yeah, so the economics, you know, are very critical, and we have economists who are, you know, working on our team, you know, looking at, you know, exactly these kinds of issues, you know, from looking at the agricultural landscape to, you know, as we, you know, looking down the production pipeline to, you know, what we might be seeing in terms of price. And one of the things is this is all really very relative to what happens to the price of petroleum, crude oil, fossil fuels in general. And so it's kind of a moving target in terms of, you know, what's going to be economical, and we're constantly trying to look forward to gauge that. But there's a lot of unknowns there in terms of fuel consumption and, you know, when will peak oil, so to speak, occur. Now, that said, you know, and it's interesting that you would call, you know, as a truck driver in terms of and considerations of diesel, and it's clearly, you know, it's very important that we be looking at kind of the diversity of fuel needs that are out there. The good news is that long run, when we look at biofuels as an opportunity and using, you know, these types of biomass that we're talking about, clearly currently a lot of our production is focused on ethanol, which can then be used as a substitute for gasoline, largely to go into cars. But it really, you know, as we look towards the future and we look at the technologies, whether it be using, you know, enzymes from biological systems as catalysts or microbes or non-biological catalytic systems, it looks very doable that we should be able to produce diesel-like fuels that would really be able to address needs in the trucking industry, and very much in parallel, actually, is also the needs for jet fuel as well. And so we're really looking at, you know, broadly, you know, the broad spectrum of needs that we have out there in terms of bioenergy and these types of liquid transportation fuels.
Mm-hmm. You were going to add something?
Had another half of that question to get to regarding our former vice president and
jobs and
And I'm not an expert on that. I don't really know exactly what the caller was getting at, but all I can say is that among the scientific community, people, the experts, you know, there's a consensus on climate change. I'd like to point out also that regardless of whether climate continues to change in the future, and it has changed in Wisconsin, the Midwest, and the world. And I can rattle off all the statistics and things you want if we had, you know, several hours to talk about it. But I think here in Wisconsin, we've seen evidence just in the last few years, these, you know, extreme weather events, whether it's flooding in 2007, 2008, we're really ill prepared to handle extreme weather events the way it is right now, whether or not climate continues to change in the future. And I think that's just a signal that we need to pay more attention to these types of issues and do more research and try to find ways to help people adapt. And it might mean changing infrastructure when it comes to flooding and that. So,
Will, thanks again for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to give Craig in Onalaska a chance to join in. Craig, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I'd like to give an example and then ask a question. If you have a vehicle that gets 30 miles to the gallon, drives 15,000 miles a year, uses 500 gallons of gasoline, that gasoline is going to weigh in the neighborhood of 3,000 pounds. How do they determine how much CO2 is produced by that 3,000 pounds of gasoline?
Generally, we use a conversion factor for the amount of energy produced in terms of the gases that are emitted from that gasoline. Now, I'm not an expert on that, but that's generally what I've seen done in these calculations, back-of-the-envelope type things. Yeah.
It seems to me that they come up with tons of CO2 when you only have a ton and a half of gasoline, and that's where I have my question. I just don't understand how they come up with those figures.
Yeah, John?
That's a really good question. It's not obvious yet because it doesn't, at least at first glance, seem to add up. And I think there's some chemistry in there which is really critical. And that is the carbon is coming from that fuel, and that's very concentrated carbon. But what we're talking about on the other end is carbon dioxide. So two oxygen molecules for each of those carbons. So the addition of all that oxygen, which is coming from the atmosphere in that combustion process, adds clearly a lot of additional mass. On the other side of that combustion. So you have to kind of look at that whole chemical formula. So that's a great question, and trying to understand the chemistry behind it goes a long way.
Yeah, just the statistics on that, if you just took carbon over the ratio of a weight of carbon molecule over CO2, it's only 27% of the total weight of carbon dioxide. So that's why I think people get a little confused on those.
Yeah. Well, I can see why it's easy to get confused as well. Craig, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Appreciate the call. Jim in Milwaukee, on to you now. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I'll tell you, I'm really much a proponent of alternative fuels and alternative energy sources and all that good stuff. But when it comes down to the experience of working with 10% ethanol gasoline versus a regular 100% gasoline, I get about 10% drop in my mileage when I'm with 10% ethanol. And it seems to be pretty much a wash then in terms of how much gasoline I'm actually using.
Yeah. Well, let's see what Chris has got to say. Chris Kuchar?
Yeah, I think the EPA has done, some studies, and up until a few years ago, I think there was a lot of uncertainty in whether or not there was this drop. But more and more ethanol is getting produced, and more people are actually using it, we hear more and more stories about this. If you look at the big picture, though, we have to think about the reduction in greenhouse gas emissions from that entire process and how it actually still is an overall benefit and is working towards that overall goal that we're trying to get at. So I think as time goes on and technology improves, there's a lot of people doing research out there on, conversion of a fuel to energy and different engines and that, and undoubtedly we would hope that those statistics start to work in the driver's favor, so to speak. John, do you have anything to add on that?
Well, the only thing I was going to add is that there are really multiple reasons for having that 10% ethanol blended in addition to clearly creating some biofuel input into our current systems. It also addresses some really important kind of broader emission concerns in the nature of the combustion process in the cars, and creates a cleaner emission. And so that really drives a lot as well. So we're getting multiple benefits out of having that 10% ethanol in that fuel. And where we go, from here, it's a big question. Clearly, there are, there's E85 vehicles out there, and you see some drop. It's not linear, as you're saying. I mean, E85 vehicles do see lower miles per gallon than, a standard gasoline car, but it still makes for reasonable mileage for most cars. The other thing that's interesting is coming down the pike is very different types of engine technology. There are engines out there which can get better miles per gallon from ethanol than gasoline. It has to do with the compression ratios out there. So you can design an engine that's actually more efficient on ethanol versus gasoline, and that's something which we might see in the future.
All right. There you go. Thanks for calling. Claire in Lake Geneva, let's go to you. Hi, Claire.
Wow. Hi. Okay, I just really was wondering if you have a response to this concern that, a lot of people, whenever I hear people talk about global warming lately, I mean people who don't believe it, they say that, and I'm talking about, like, people who I would think would be concerned. Like, I'm a student at a university, and I hear this from professors, that they don't take global warming seriously. It's not an urgent issue anymore because they don't believe that scientists are being honest about their data. This whole climate gate issue that was, a couple years ago, and they just think that scientists are manipulating the data.
Yeah, and that's something that I'm pretty sure Chris Kucharik would like to respond to.
Yeah, I think the unfortunate thing is that the media out there, and I'm going to just go out and say that a lot of the media out there are not experts. They don't do investigative reporting on the facts about climate change and this whole ClimateGate thing and cooking the books on climate data, totally unfounded. There was a third-party independent investigation that looked into that. If you want statistics for Wisconsin, I've actually used data that comes right from cooperative observers here in our own state. Might be your neighbor, your mom and dad, your spouse, every day collecting daily high and low and precipitation information since the late 1800s. You can get that data right off a website from NOAA. Look at it yourself. Do your own statistics and find out that it's been untouched. It's in its raw format. And I didn't have to depend on some organization, which was in East Anglia, which is where this whole thing started up a couple of years ago. So in the scientific community, there's more and more papers coming out that are looking at the nature of who's saying what, you know, where is a consensus. And those that are experts on climate change, those that have published records that have been researching, there's unequivocal 97% confidence that what we're seeing is due to human activity and us putting more greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. It's the laws of physics. We can't change that. There's a small set of skeptics out there who will cherry-pick facts and basically keep cherry-picking and cherry-picking until they're able to get their viewpoints across and try to persuade you that this isn't happening. And it's mainly because of fear of regulation and what that might mean to our economy and costs. So, but I would encourage anyone out there listening, if you have any doubts about this, please contact me. I would be happy to debate it with you.
Okay. How do they contact you?
You can reach me at the university. Send me an email, kucharik@wisc.edu. You can call me on the phone, area code 608-890-3021. That's a direct line to my office. And believe me, I do have people contact me about this. So no surprises.
No, and just to mention, go back to the GLBRC for a minute. Your website has a lot of the information about the work that's going on, John. And what's that website again?
Yeah, thank you, Larry. Yeah, www.glbrc.org will get you to information about the 60-plus projects that we're involved in, trying to develop sustainable biofuels. You can even find that contact information for Chris on our website. Really details the full spectrum of research that that we're involved in.
So glbrc.org.
Yep.
O-R-G. Guys, it's been great. Obviously, we had lots more questions and comments than we have time for today. So I hope you'll come back and be with us again.
Definitely, Larry. This was a great time. So I hope you do welcome us back, at least especially
Thanks,
me.
Well, we'll bring John back, too. John,
yeah.
Thank you.
John Greenler is Education and Outreach Program Director for the GLBRC, and that, again, stands for the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. Chris Kucharik, a professor here at the UW-Madison, associated with the Departments of Agronomy and the Center for Sustainability and Global Environment and the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies, and also, obviously, associated with and doing work in the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. And we'll have those guys back, and you can have Adam again on another time. Thanks again, guys.
Okay. Thanks.
We will, if you want to talk about burning your own energy a little bit, burning human energy, one of my favorite things to do in the wintertime is cross-country ski. And you're not using any fossil fuels, a little of your own fuel that you've stored up, and I've got a lot of extra fuel that I need to get rid of in the form of calories. So it's great to do that in wintertime, at least for me. What about for you? We're going to talk cross-country skiing in Wisconsin with Chad McGrath. He's been with us a number of times. He's the author of 5 books, including Great Cross-Country Ski Trails in Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan, and Ontario, and Stride and Glide, A Guide to Wisconsin's Best Cross-Country Ski Trails. And he's our guest coming up next on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.